Hi everybody, this is Mahan, and you might know me from a show called Paris by Night. I used to be one of the singers for a pretty long time. I had to retire in 2010 due to my health condition. I got a diagnosis with Parkinson's disease in 2009. And ever since, I'm happily married. And I'm working together right now. I'm working with my husband as a creative director and stylist in our photography business. And yeah, that's about it. And I'm excited to be here to talk to you guys.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over.
Thank you so much. What a beautiful introduction. It's been such a long time. I think the last time we both saw each other was in, I think, 99.
Well, 99, that's when I moved to from Vienna to LA. So I might probably 2000,
yeah. So it's been almost 25 years now. And we ran into each other at a birthday party just recently. And it was so lovely to see you and to meet your
host. I was so shocked to see you. It was so funny.
Yeah, it was such a long time ago. All right. Well, why don't we start by talking about your childhood? Because I think growing up in Vienna is such a big deal that most Vietnamese people don't really get to hear and talk about. Tell me what that was like for you growing up there.
Oh, gosh. You know, every time I think and speak about Austria, I get really emotional because it's where I come from. That's who I am until this very day. Even though I've been living in the US for so long, it really shaped me for the person I am today. I mean, I left Vietnam in 75 and we came with my family. I have two brothers and one sister. With my parents, we came to Austria. We actually fled by boat, and we were picked up by a big ship from Denmark called Jungson, and we were at the refugee camp in Hong Kong, and at the time, 1975, everybody wanted to go to the U.S. Everybody wanted to immigrate to the U.S. and of course my parents as well, and so when they were asked in an interview whether they had any relations to the with the U.S., had any relatives in the U.S., my parents said no. They were being really honest. The truth is, a lot of people lied at that time, and they came through. But my parents were just honest about it and said, no, we didn't know anybody. We don't have any relations to the U.S. So they wouldn't let us go. They let all the other people go first. And so we were at the camp, refugee camp, for quite a while, a couple of months. And my parents were so scared that they would send us back. Of course, we wouldn't have done this, but it was so afraid that seeing this family being stuck in this camp for so long that they would send it back. So they basically chose a country that would take us right away without any questions, or not a lot of questions. At least that was Austria. So my parents didn't know much about Austria at the time. They went to the movie theater and they went and watched the movie Sissi, which is the movie about the Austrian Empress. They thought, wow, it's such a beautiful country. And they portrayed it pretty nice and it was beautiful. So they thought that if it's this beautiful, then the people must be very nice too. So we that's why we ended up in Austria. And so my family and I, my siblings, were actually one of the first Vietnamese families in Austria. And so growing up there wasn't easy because we all, of course, didn't speak the language. And there's this family with four kids and not knowing anything. And so in the beginning, we were at the refugee camp, another camp in Vienna. And my dad found a job in a factory that produces coffee. And my mom was working in a factory as well. So they were just normal workers. So just regular workers. And then later on, this is where I am so proud of my parents, and I'm so overwhelmed by this, is that I don't know how they were able to raise four children in this country by themselves. and providing us with the best, because all four of us went to private school. We were, all went to private school, Catholic school. We were able to graduate, you know, my siblings with honors. I barely made it through high school, but so
why did they all make it through with honors, and why did you barely make it through high school?
She's the creative one.
You're creative, but it wasn't because you were ditching school or partied or anything like that.
No. I was a lazy student. I didn't want to study. It's really weird. I barely made it to high school. Well, it was math and other subjects that I wasn't good at. And all my siblings are so good at what they're doing. You know, they're so mean. And I was so jealous because they were all so smart and they graduated. And so, but what I love about my parents is that they were never, you know, they never held a grudge. They were always supportive of us kids. And they knew that I was interested in other things. Obviously, I was very into fashion. I wanted to go to fashion school. So my mom actually supported. She goes, if you want to go to fashion school, that's fine. But you still need to finish high school. And so I graduated from high school. But then, so destiny kicked in. And so by the age of 19, I actually sang for Paris Ballet for the first time. And so I was discovered in Paris in 1990. And
we're leaving out a whole chunk of information. Well, you were interested in fashion, but also music at the time growing up, weren't you?
Well, the thing is, the music part came from my dad, because we are a music loving family. My dad is a very good singer. My mom loves singing. She was great, but she loves singing. And then so here comes the very, 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 very important part. Growing up in Austria, we didn't have a lot of friends, Vietnamese friends, and not a lot of opportunities to speak Vietnamese. So slowly, my siblings and I, we've kind of forgot how to speak Vietnamese. And so my dad figured that the only way for us kids to learn Vietnamese is by teaching them, is by making them wanting to learn Vietnamese. You can't force anybody, you just have to make them want. And what's the best way? Through music. So through music you will be able to learn and enjoy at the same time and have fun and entertain. So that was it. Yeah, so he started this band.
Yeah, how old were you?
I was when we started the band, I was 12, about 12 years old. Yeah.
And you
were
before that?
I was not, sorry.
You were not singing before 12?
It was just fun. It was never, no appearances, no performances, nothing. It was just, I was a kid, I was 12. I was busy thinking about things like boys. So I was busy with that. So, and then when my dad started his band, because my brother played the drums. He picked up drums just because he liked playing drums. My second brother, he was playing bass. My uncle played the guitar, and my sister was assigned to play keyboard because she was taking piano lessons. But truthfully, she was not into this at all. So that's how we started as a band, a family band. And then what started out to be just like a for fun kind of thing, and at the time I wasn't singing either. I was just a groupie. I was just following the family around, the band around, whenever we had any shows in Vienna or something like this, you know, Daniel Ho or something like this. I just came along just to hang out, until one day my uncle sang a song. It's called it's by Mike Oldfield, Moonlight Shadow, back in the 80s. And he was singing, it was during rehearsal, he was singing the song, and he didn't know the lyrics. So I sang the song, and I go, go, and then so he sang it, and then he goes, and then he looked at me, he goes, why don't you sing this song? And I go, okay, well, I'm sure, okay. So that's how it started. I started to sing just for fun, and just because I was just happened to be there. And then I sang more and more. And then in the beginning, I sang a lot of Vietnamese songs because my dad was so particular in terms of what we should sing, to make us, for people to respect us, because it's a very small community, and it was very important for us, to always keep, keep faith and make sure that, we are very respected. So yeah, so nothing like wild, nothing wild came late on. So this was just very, I sang a lot of Phạm Duy song, I sang Tuổi Mộng Mơ. That's Tuổi Mơ. It's a Tuổi Mơ. It's actually that's Phạm Duy. Em ước mơ mơ gì tuổi 12, tuổi 13, em ước mơ mơ đó. So yeah, so very beautiful Vietnamese songs, and I sang a lot of Chu Lâm Phương songs as well. So that's how it started. And then the band would, as we were performing all over Austria, all of a sudden there were all these vacation camps in Europe, where thousands and thousands of Vietnamese people from all over Europe would come together and celebrate, just our culture. And we heard about it in Austria, it's very small, so we heard about it. So we packed our stuff. We heard that there was also going to be so we packed up all our instruments and just came along and traveled to the Netherlands, traveled to Belgium, Germany, and started playing, for people to listen to see us. And we actually made a name, within Europe. People actually talked about, Maniac Govang.
So when you go to all these places, are you scheduled already to sing and perform, or is it just like you show up and you just perform?
No. We told the organizers that we have a band. If they are interested, they will be, just come bring, just sing along. So we were not the only band at the time. So every time we traveled to all these places, there were several bands. There was a band from Belgium. There was a band from Holland. There's a band from Norway. We were the band from Austria. It's these kind of activities, these camps, they were so important to me. And at that time, especially when you're a teenager, you're having this identity crisis at all times, because you know you're Asian, but especially in Austria, there were no Asians, there were no Vietnamese, there's nothing. And my sister and I were the only two Asian girls in the entire school. So, for example, so everybody else was just Caucasian. And so when I came to Holland to this youth camp for the first time, actually it was Belgium was first, 1986, it's called Lang Vietnam. There was probably the awakening of my everything for me came clear when I saw all these thousands of Vietnamese kids in one camp, and it was so much fun. But the saddest thing is, because we were all from all over Europe, we were all Vietnamese, but none of us spoke Vietnamese. Oh. So we had to communicate somehow. We all communicated in English, and that's so bizarre because we were like. It doesn't make any sense. We are all Vietnamese, but how come we speak English to each other? So that was, for me, was just an eye-opening and life-changing experience when I realized that, I am Vietnamese and I'm going to learn it, because it's sad to see how all these kids, communicate in English. And then even after when we went back home and we kept in touch and writing letters to each other, it was always in English. Yeah, it's universal language, but it's sad, just because knowing that we are who we are, So, that was definitely a life changing experience for me in many ways, culture wise.
What is that camp called?
One was called 1986 was Lang Vietnam, and then the one in 1987 I was in Holland called Hùng Vương.
And do they
still
to this day with these camps?
I honestly don't know, because after that they had these camps, but they were just smaller. Yeah, they had several camps in Holland, but there were only kids from the Netherlands, so it was not international the one in 1986. We were talking about Mitchungan.
Wow. It's so crazy.
It was insane. It's insane.
This episode is brought to you by Red Boat Fish Sauce. I love cooking with Red Boat because it's made with only two ingredients: wild-caught anchovies and sea salt. This premium fish sauce is made in Phu Quoc, Vietnam, and bottled right here in California. You can find Red Boat at select Asian supermarkets like 99 Ranch, H Mart, and Tong Fak.
Yeah, it's insane because I didn't know that this existed. You know, like these camps existed, and they're for fun. They sound so fun to go to.
It was because I learned from all these camps. I learned so much. I learned all these songs. You know, these kid, like children's songs, like just like so it's all so all these things I learned from these camps. So I was very, 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 very happy at the time. Yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah. And then in 87 when I sang at the last evening, they had this big concert, and I was performing my song. Actually, I was performing the Final Countdown by Europe.
Yeah.
It was insane. It was just so insane. Because for the first time in my life, I stood in front of thousands and thousands of people. I was 14 at the time. And I sort of felt these people, and they're all jumping and dancing and singing. And I was like, I like this. This is nice. This is, I can get used to this. And then... next thing I knew, we were continuing with our music, and we sang more. I sang more and more, and then I back to Austria. I also joined an Austrian band. So just because my brother was in the band, we all at the time, you know, everybody wanted to be in a band. Everybody wanted to be a rock star. So my brother was in a band, and then I joined them, and I was the main singer of that Austrian rock band for a while as well. So yeah, so I was singing Vietnamese and English rock. At the same time, but that, again, it was all just for fun. I never thought of becoming a singer at all. It was just something that I truly enjoyed, and I just loved. I loved the feeling of being on stage. That's how it all started. And so, what happened with Paris by Night is that was total coincidence, because I was in Paris in 1990, yeah, and I was at the time I was working for a Vietnamese fashion designer, Bac Thanh Le. He's old school. He made all these Ao Yai, and I was working for him because one of his models, and one night he had a fashion show, and he asked all the models. Fashion show. If anybody wanted to sing a song, and I said, "Yeah, I like to sing," so I sang a song that night in Paris, and it was just a restaurant. It was just a Vietnamese Chinese restaurant, nothing big. Yeah. But somebody was in the audience at night and saw me perform. That was Go Thuy Nga, Madame Thuy Nga herself. She was there, and she liked me. Told the bartender that he said, "I'm interested in the girl. So that's how we met, and then I performed on. So I was invited to perform on the next Paris by Night, which was Paris by Night 16, and I was 18 and 19 at the time. So I joined Paris by Night in 1992, yeah, and. That's how it is, and the rest is history. Yeah, I started Paris by Night 16, 1992. Yeah.
So in 92, you were just finishing high school, right?
Yes.
Just done with high school,
right.
And you had to move to the United States, or were you just flying back?
No, I was flying back and forth. Yeah. So that was I didn't want to leave Austria. I didn't want to leave because I wasn't sure how I could make it in the U.S. You know, I lost a lot of time by doing that because I could have, it's just because I was very young and I there's no way I could have moved over there by myself. You know, I wanted to stay in Austria. I wanted to make sure that I was around my family. So I traveled back and forth a lot, but because of that, I couldn't pursue anything for real. I could neither go to school 100% and I couldn't pursue my career as a singer 100%. Everything was just like half because, you know, it was just, I was, Yeah, back and forth a lot. I missed so many things, missed class, missed important appointments in the U.S. So it was just not, you know, it did. So I think it did it for like good 92 until 99. That's how long it took me. Because I moved to US in 99, like officially moved in 99.
Yeah.
That's how much time I lost, a lot of years, 7 years.
When you look back, would you think back? Would you have changed things? Would you have moved back?
I would have moved sooner. Yeah,
and it was just because you were missing your family and you didn't want the change that you didn't move sooner.
Right. I was just scared to move to the US by myself. I was just, because I know nobody could go with me. I didn't know, you know, we didn't have any relatives in the US. Nobody, we had no relatives, because my dad at the time, my mom's family moved to Austria, and my dad's family, you know, they were back in Vietnam. So there was nobody for me in the US that I could have stayed, or that I could have, you know, started my whole new life.
What made you decide in 1999? Why that year did you decide to move to the US?
I just felt like I needed to stay at one place where I could do both. Obviously, I thought enough is enough. Enough. You're grown up now. You stand on your own feet and just do it. And so I that's where I applied for a student visa, and I went to school at the same time too. I went to LAT, Los Angeles Trade Technical College, LATTC, and studied fashion design. Yeah, so that's what I did. I did fashion design and I sang at the same time, and it was the craziest time, because I had to, you know, I had to file all these homework and this work and that I had to physically make it, dresses that I should make. And while I'm still singing, I backstage, I was on the floor drawing and painting my collection for my next class while I'm in my costume. So that was fun. Or I would have a show on Sunday, like maybe like in Washington D.C., and I flew back on Monday morning back to L.A. and go straight to school from there. And it was a little bit crazy, yeah, but it was all worth it. I enjoyed it, and I graduated as a fashion designer. Yeah.
Now, when you look back on the time at Paris by Night, what are some of the most memorable things for you? What are some of like the most special memories that you've had?
Oh boy, so too many. I mean, I've learned tons of things at Paris by Night, and next to Austria, Paris by Night is definitely the one thing in my life that shaped me and made me who I am today. For sure, it's definitely Austria, my family, and Paris by Night. It was hard in the beginning because first of all, my Vietnamese wasn't great. I didn't speak or sang well, because I most of the time I didn't understand what I was singing. That's the fun part. And then I would sing, and then my producer asked me, "Do you know what you're singing?" I'm like, "Lana Roy." You know, it's a very, you know, explain to me, you know, Vietnamese is a very how do you call it, a very metaphor. Metaphor.
A lot of metaphors, yes.
Yeah. So you say you're singing about the leaf that's falling, but it actually means that they're broken up, you know, the couple broke up, something like this, you know. So you have to understand what it means. So that I had no understanding, no whatsoever. I didn't know, like, okay, if you say this, it actually means that. I didn't know all of that. I didn't. So it was very challenging. But I learned so much about my culture, and I learned so much about the language. I definitely learned how to speak Vietnamese more. And that's definitely, singing taught me how to speak Vietnamese, you know, better. So things I remember the most, goodness, or what events? I guess. Okay, I sang for a very long time. Actually, I started Paris by Night in 92, right? And it wasn't until 2003 or 2004 that I was allowed to come up with my own ideas and suggestions for my performances. Before that, it was Marito, producer too, who was guiding me, who was my definitely my teacher, my guide. She was the one who decided what for me what to sing, what to wear, you know, what to do and stuff like this. And I enjoyed it, but it was not completely 100% me until 2003, 2004. I was allowed to make my own decisions, make my own suggestions and ideas. And so that's when the career truly took off. And I remember that by singing this one song called "Wood Gifung Ba." It's a Chinese. It's actually originally a Chinese song, but it was translated into Vietnamese, and I sang this song with the concept. The idea behind this song was I wanted to play this character of a warrior. You know, it's a girl, but she wants to be a warrior. It's almost like Mulan, yeah, kind of thing. But she's very strong, and she's this strong personality, and does all the things that a man does. And it's just at one point in this one in the song that I show some vulnerability.
Yeah.
And so that was the song that completely took off like this. That was the song that people.
You're wearing a hat, right? With the, it's like this.
Yeah.
It's a gray hat. You're wearing a gray Shaolin suit.
Yeah. Yes. That's the one. That's the one that people still talk and ask me about it until this very day. I think it was just that I put my heart and my soul into this. I'm sorry. Do you see the light flickering?
It's perfect. I can see you perfectly. Yep.
Okay. Flickering. that I feel like it was truly me, and then I think from that moment on, Chi Thuy understood that I like the theatrical component in my performance. That whatever I do, whatever I perform on stage, there's always a little bit of a theatrical drama. Kind of aspect component, because I like to play different characters. And Paris by Night is not a regular music show. It's a cultural, it's a mix of cultural and entertainment. And so it's actually very educating. The Paris by Night is very educating. I think more, maybe it was more educated back in the days when I was still there. And it has always these songs where there's a story, like a historical figure is, you know, playing the main part or something like that. So yeah, it was just very, very theatrical. I really enjoyed that. Yeah. So.
And so, did you ever think about writing your own music after that?
I can't do it. I'm not good at this. I don't think that I've ever tried. But at the same time, you know what is really odd, because at the time, I love to write, like I love writing my blog. I had a blog before, and I was writing, and the people enjoyed my reading. But I couldn't sit down and actually write something more like something more poetic in terms of lyrics for a song. I couldn't do this. I was just it was very raw the way I wrote my blog about things, how I see things, you know. And I think that's what people like. People like the fact that it was pretty raw and, you know, it was straightforward. And no, there was no hiding behind the bushes. It was just, that's who I am, taking it or leave it. But I, in terms of poetic, in putting words in a manner that you can actually sing it and make it understand that it's how you feel. I couldn't do this. I was never good at that.
Wow, interesting. Now, do you think that, you know, I think about most of the singers and performers of Paris by Night were Vietnamese Americans. A lot of them grew up in the United States. I mean, they must have been, you know, a little bit older when they got here, but for the most part, they're American, they're Vietnamese, but with American, you know, upbringing. You are one of the few that came from Europe. How could you talk about a little bit about how different you were compared to the people that you were performing with?
Oh boy. Oh boy. Well, first of all, there was a language problem, because I didn't speak Vietnamese well, and it was not my first language. But and that sort of how do you say? I mean, I don't want to say that I had to prove myself a lot. That's the thing, you know. So I think that's why I was saying that, you know, the song "Wood Gifung Ba," took off. That's where my career took off, because it was completely 100% me. Whereas the years before, I did what I was told to do, and it didn't feel right. And so my Vietnamese was just not just not. Yeah, because I couldn't feel it, and I think the audience could feel it too. Hmm. So, and as far as working with my other comic colleagues, I had a hard time because my mentality. Not only did I speak the language, my mentality was I was actually very shy at the time. So I was very shy. I didn't, especially coming from Europe, and nobody knows where Europe. Nobody knows anything about Austria.
Right.
What is Austria? And then you used, all of a sudden, you're among all these big celebrities like Ebs Fung, Lina Chang Dai. It was very intimidating, So so it was definitely very insecurity that occupied me for the first few years. But then later on, when I understood again, when I found my strength in terms of entertaining and performing, that's when I became more confident. And I was more outgoing. So I think in the beginning, people thought probably that I was very stuck up because I didn't talk much. I really didn't talk much.
Yeah.
Backstage, I didn't know what to do. I just sat there and just did my own business. But because I didn't know how to communicate in Vietnamese, I was afraid people were going to make fun of me, so I didn't speak Vietnamese.
Wow.
Yeah, but later, then so it got better and I was able to communicate. That's when people actually saw that I'm actually a very outgoing person. And I was, of course, more confident in terms of the person who I am and my work. And so, yeah. So all these years until the very end, I would always think that I might not be the greatest singer. I might not be, you know, like vocally, I'm not as certain singers there are who are incredibly amazing and talented. But I still believe that there's something that I had that nobody had.
Yeah.
I was just, I was, like I said, the theatrical component, that was something that I think was the one thing that my fans loved. They loved the fact that they never knew what to expect, what Bahan's going to offer, you know, she's going to do in the next Thursday night. I always switched to different characters. I was playing a boy for many songs. It's the funny thing. I remember one time I went to Kelvin here, the designer in Orange County. I went to this store and there was a lady in the store, and she saw me coming in, and then she asked Anhip, "What is that, Bahan?" And he goes, "Yeah, that's Bahan." He goes, she goes, "Oh my, I'll tell you that guy again. So just video tell you then only because." I've played so many characters. I've played many characters because I had no problem.
Why do you think you picked playing a lot of male characters?
I didn't pick. It was given to me. I took it because I was happy. Because I think because my features are kind of like not soft. You know, I don't look typical Vietnamese. I know I'm not Vietnamese, and. I think maybe my features is probably why. I'm not feminine. I think I'm just like more of a square. So, yeah. And also because I think it's also, and I believe that they had faith in me. They believed that I could pull it off. You know, for example, like Timo Linchua, I played a role of a monk, but she was a woman, but she lives a life as a monk, as a male, and want people to believe that she's a male. But there's this one girl, which is played by Ivan, Timo, her name's Timo. She is in love with this monk. She doesn't know it's a woman. She thinks it's a man. So she keeps on flirting with him, but she keeps on like, you know, trying to seduce him. But this monk keeps on running away. So she gets really, I'm such a pretty girl. How come he doesn't even pay attention to it? It's like a sad and a funny story. It was on Thursday night as well.
Now,
that was me.
You know, it's so strange to think back in 1999 when you were so kind to sing on stage with me. And I, you know, in our minds at the time when, you know, we go through these experiences, we have
a completely different perspective of what the reality is for the other person that's living, right? Because in my brain, I was, you know, I was a student at the time, and I kept thinking that you were a professional. You were singing for many years already. You were singing, but to think about the choices that you did not have to pick your own music, to not be a part of that process, it boggles my mind, because, you know, I thought about in 1999, thinking back how powerful, you know, you were when you appeared on stage, when you appeared on screen, the power that you had was, you know, anything, it was nothing that I'd ever witnessed before in my life. But looking back now, you think about the progression of an artist and the way that we are given sort of agency to navigate the life that we want is not really there in our early days.
Yes, I mean, I think it's simply because she didn't know yet. She didn't know yet how what potential I have. It was more like a making sure that, you know, that I fell, you know. I would say, you know, something that because she's the expert, she's obviously the expert, she's the producer. She should know, you know, she would know what sells. And so she didn't believe in that sense yet that I would be able to, give her the material to, you know, succeed. So because I was still very young. But then, like I said, later on, and with all the things that that I showed on stage, I think she finally understood that, you know, that I was good enough now to make my own decisions and to make my own, to give my own ideas and concepts and stuff. So, yeah. But yeah, I mean, and like you said, I was very, very lucky, very happy that they always gave me, they challenged me. They did challenge me to give me songs that were hard to sing, that were very, very challenging. I was very happy about that.
This episode is brought to you by Songkhai Distillery, my only go-to gin company. Established in 2018, Songkhai Distillery is Vietnam's first gin distillery, founded by Daniel Nguyen, a Vietnamese American from Southern California. No matter how many people I have at my parties, we are always pouring Songkhai gin. Songkhai gin is handcrafted in small batches and prioritizes using botanicals and ingredients that are native and heirloom to Vietnam. The result is a product uniquely Vietnamese in taste and aroma. Songkhai is now growing to include rice wine and traditional Vietnamese herbal liqueurs similar to Amaro. Songkhai prides itself in Vietnam, from the farmers who grow the fruits and herbs to the artists behind the artwork and design. Songkhai is a community effort of people who are proud to be Vietnamese and collectively embody the spirit of Vietnam.
Now, did you at any time want to change the face of Paris by Night as you got more confident? Did you ever think that this is a musical genre or a label, entertainment label, that needs to have an infusion of sort of an American point of view or more European point of view to take it out of the Vietnamese culture? Or did you think that this was a perfect place, that it was always going to be what it is going to be?
I was very surprised to see that they're still surviving. I'm surprised to see that they're still doing what, you know, because I thought it would have been over a long time ago because of the internet and everything, you know, because at the time we recorded everything and everything was shot on and sold on DVDs. So this is something that obviously we can't do that anymore, but,
right.
And then not only that, and then also the concept of Paris by Night, it hasn't changed. So yeah, if you ask me, honestly, I have to say, yeah, I mean, I would have loved to, you know, to jump on the board if she had ever asked me to join and be basically part of the creative team, you know, creative team for the show. I would have done quite a few things differently. I mean, like change it up, not differently, but just change it up,
right?
Just to make it more
mainstream.
Because mainstream, yeah. Because I mean, there are so many talented kids, in the U.S. that are still struggling, you know. I would have loved to do something like, you know, and even my husband actually is he does marketing. He actually was the one also had ideas that he wanted to do, almost like do like a festival, music festival, but you know, just instead of two festivals, let's do a festival or something like this, and just promote young talents in the US, you know, instead of singing these old Vietnamese songs over and over again. But that changed completely, because now we have all these another source of, I guess, music, that's the all the artists from Vietnam. Because back in the days, at the time that we didn't, when I was during my time, all these singers from Vietnam were not as popular as they are today. So later on, it just eventually, slowly, all these big artists from Vietnam became more influential, and they became bigger and bigger, you know. So now we are actually dealing with that. So it's basically two different markets, you know, the Vietnamese American, and then the Vietnamese market, that somehow a little bit, it's somehow slowly, you know, into job. But I think it's very, still very, very separated. Yeah, very, you know, the style it's different. It's they're different.
Yeah,
I'm not bad in a way. They're very good, actually. I mean, I admire these singers from Vietnam. I think they're amazing talents, and the music is great. I can't, but there are obviously more people, so
feel like the singers from Vietnam actually have two advantages that they have going on now. Actually, three. Mm-hmm. The first advantage is a lot of them are trained singers. And I feel like Paris by Night didn't have the training, the real depth of the vocal training. A lot of them did, but most of them didn't. A lot of them just came up as in families like yours and became singers, right? And I don't think there's anything wrong with that, but the real root of the training, the stamina, the power, the technique, I think when you analyze Vietnamese singers, a lot of them come from schools that train in conservator, you know, all of these big institutions in Vietnam. I think the second thing that they have is they have the power of many songwriters now in Vietnam, whereas in the United States, in Paris by Night, in Asia, we didn't have the luxury of songwriters because of the way royalties are structured or the way the business is structured. On the Vietnamese American side, there was no real big sources of Vietnamese songwriters. And then I think the third thing that they have is a huge advantage is the amount of people that they have now. They have over 100 million people in Vietnam, and that audience is now middle class. There's a lot of middle class people that could afford, you know, concerts and all kinds of entertainments in Vietnam.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. So the truth is, you can't really compare this, because it's like we're talking about, I don't know how many million people, Vietnamese people in the US, and how many million people in Vietnam. So it can't really compare, because it's too overwhelming over there. And it definitely, they have more people, and that's the main thing. What I find very interesting, though, is, and I mean, I'm happy that it's booming like this, yes, because it gives us Asians, you know, more presence in the international market,
right?
Because Asians obviously were never really represented until now, K-pop, you know. And actually, I have a theory why all these years the Asians were not strong. I know why.
What is your theory?
Okay, so my theory is, when you talk about Caucasian music, we talk about rock. When you talk about African American music, we talk with jazz. When we talk about Latino music, we're talking about salsa, cha-cha, whatever. Asian, what's Asian? There's nothing really that stands for Asian music. There's nothing. Says that represents Asian music other than K-pop, but it's not even Korean. It's just pop. When they're singing Korean, that's all it is. So I think all these years there was just this one music, that kind of genre, that represents the Asian culture, and that's why we were never strong enough to, you know, make it through internationally mainstream. We never did. That's my theory. I'm not sure, but
that theory, because anything you think of with an Asian face was not going to work, right?
Yeah, exactly.
In the 80s, the 90s, the 70s, if you put like an Asian man on a rock face or on a rap face or salsa music, it's not going to work. Or country music, it's not going to work.
As much as I loved Coco Lee, and I think she had an amazing amazing voice. She sang like she was like a Mariah Carey, but it didn't work. It's not the same in Europe.
Yeah, you can't cross over as Coco Lee was a little bit too early for her time. She was an R&B singer at the time. You're right. You're absolutely right. She was very, very, very talented.
Yeah, but that's not what people wanted to see or hear. They rather listen to Mariah Carey rather than Coco Lee, who is Asian, and it's obviously not her music. It's R&B. It's definitely African American. It's not Asian.
Yeah.
Yeah. The one thing that's missing. So yeah. So that was my theory for all these years, but I'm happy now with K-pop. I'm very happy that it's giving us some sort of presence, you know, in mainstream. So, but yeah, and it's obviously very strong because Vietnam is copying Korea. Vietnam is not copying America. Yeah. Vietnam is copying. It's totally copying Korea. You know.
And I used to be worried about Vietnam copying Korea. And then somebody told me, I think it was a sociologist or a history professor said to me, you don't need to worry about that because what happens is K-pop is the best of the best of what Britney Spears and NSYNC and Backstreet Boys were doing. Koreans took that music and really got really good at it. And you can't get the best of the best until you do somebody else's stuff and you perfect it. So what Vietnam, the hope that I have is what Vietnam does is they take Korean K-pop and they get really good at doing what K-pop is doing. And then Nafangra, they do their own, it becomes their own V-pop and it becomes their own. Yes. So you have to master one language first.
Yeah.
And once you master the other, that language, then you can do your language and make the world know about your language. And that's what Koreans do.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, it's very interesting. So can we get into, I want to know your history about, you know, your Parkinson's diagnosis. When did it come about in your life? And when did you start noticing this to be part of your life?
I think it was in 2006. I'm not sure. I'm not quite sure. Well, first of all, it's pretty much, okay, Parkinson's is not, it's not proven that Parkinson's is actually
hereditary.
It's not, supposedly not. So, but it seems like that's in my family. It's the case though, because my mom had it. My mom just passed away in July. So my mom had it, my uncle has it, my brother has it, and I have number four. So that, you know, that I think pretty much says it all. But I noticed the first symptoms in 2000 and I think 2006. And I noticed it because I saw the same symptoms with my mom. I saw how it happened to my mom. So whatever happened to my mom pretty much happened to me as well. And then I guess the shock wasn't, it was big, but it was just not like, I was prepared for this. And the thing is, because I actually went to several neurologists because it's not sometimes it's not really clear, you know, you just have to wait and see. So that's why I went to so many neurologists and a lot of them actually told me that it's not. And then, but then it's not that I wanted to believe what they wanted to believe. So the last doctor that I went to, she ran some tests and she says, it is what it is. It's Parkinson's. So I go, that's what, and it, for me, it was like, see, I told you. It was more than that kind of reaction rather than, oh my God. It's like, you see, I told you. So we wasted all this time. If you guys had just diagnosed me sooner, then maybe we can do something about this. But it was a couple of years that I had to, go from one doctor to another doctor just to get the diagnosis that I was expecting. And it was just minor things, you know. Because with Parkinson's, you there's a tremor that, when you sit still, that's usually when the tremor happens. Like it's like this kind of motion. But I also had the essential tremor that inherited from my dad. My dad essential tremor. It's just you just shake, you know, when you try to open a bottle, for example, or when you try to eat soup or something. That's when you shake. But the tremor with Parkinson's is when you sit still and you still your body still moving. So that's Parkinson's. So and I noticed that in my finger that. One time I was sitting in the office, I saw how my little pinky started to make this move. So that's how it usually starts. And then from there, I noticed that it was hard for me to pick things up. It was hard for me to hold things. So and then I drop things all the time. Yeah, so that's the next thing. For me right now, as of now, I have the most difficulty with my stiffness rather than my tremor. The tremor is there. I can deal with this, but it's the stiffness, because once the stiffness kick in, I can't do anything. I can't nothing. And it's just very, very annoying, and it's draining. And then at the end of the day, my body aches. But you know, like I said, I've been living it for so long now. I've been living it with it since 2010. I mean, so since 2009, official diagnosis. That I used it, you know. And one thing that I learned, that was there was a very wise doctor who told me that, Bahan, you can't have a happy life if you don't accept it. Because once you accept it, you learn to live with it. You know, you learn to live, you find ways to live around it. What do you need to do? Because once you've figured it all out, you can actually have a happy life. And so that's what I try to do. I try to, it is what it is. There's no reason to fight it anymore. There's no reason to question it anymore. There's no reason to, I mean, of course I am worried about the future. I don't know my biggest fear is, I don't know where this is taking me. I don't know what the end looks like. I don't know. But I feel like I can, until then, I can live my life semi-normal, because I learned how to maneuver, and learn how to, you definitely don't take things for granted anymore. Just simple things like tying my hair or washing my hair or just do makeup, these things take time. So that's one thing I learned from all this time. It's like everything needs time. Take your time. If you need more time, just start earlier. You can't rush. I can't rush it, because if I rush, nothing happens. Nothing gets done. So just take your time. Do what, and just one of the, but yeah. Yeah, so that's, but the only problem that I have right now is the fact that I can only do things when I'm flexible like this. And that's a short period of time. I take my medication 6 times a day. This is my memory. So this is what I, lots of cam. But 6 times a day, and every time it lasts for about half an hour or maybe an hour max. This medication is supposed to get me through the day, through the entire day, but it stopped because it's been so long now. So everything is like about half an hour now, half an hour, half an hour. And that half an hour, I have to do everything. I'm running my errands. I clean up the house. I answer my mail. All kinds of stuff. I have to do this all in that period of time. So it almost feels like I'm racing against time every day. Yeah, and it's partially why I talk so fast these days. That's partially the reason why I'm doing things fast, because I feel like I'm running out of time. Because if I don't finish it, then it's like the engine dies on you, and then I can do anything. Yeah, so
you know you are the fourth person in your family. But were you the last person to get it, or were you one of like the second people to get it? The what?
I'm a number two.
Number two.
I'm number two.
And
my mom was first, and then me.
And then you, and then your uncle, and then your brother.
Yes.
And how's your uncle and your brother dealing with it today?
My uncle is not doing well at all. My uncle actually had a surgery. Yeah, they actually did open his skull, and they put the chip into the brain. Because what happens is, when you have Parkinson's, there's a certain cells that help you move. The brain doesn't produce those cells anymore for some reason. Until this very day, they haven't found out why it's happening. But there are certain cells that you need, obviously, to move. So that's why Parkinson's is a movement disorder. So for some reason, the brain stops producing these cells. So the medication that I'm taking is basically a substitute. For the cells. And then, yeah, so my uncle actually had a surgery. I was I was asked if I wanted to do it, but I'm not there yet. I don't think it's the thought of it that I'm not ready for this yet. But my uncle had it done, and it didn't help at all. And no changes whatsoever. He's still doing badly. He's very weak. He's very weak. He's very shaky and stiff. My brother is okay, stable, I suppose. He's about like me, yeah. But yeah. So it's there are good days and bad days. But as long as you have medication on your medication, you're actually fine. Yeah. So it's something. It's a disease that you can definitely live with. You know, you just need to learn how to, you have to be prepared. You know, and it's. That is a progress, though. I mean, I feel the progress of this disease every day. I see how my I'm getting slower. I'm getting stiffer, and I can't. Once in a while, I can't get up. My husband has to help me getting up, and then I walk like an 80-year-old woman when the medication is off. So, and that's just people staring. Of course, it's a lot of staring, but it is what it is. So, like I said, my doctor said, just accept it.
Yeah. At some point, you were into this for a few years, and I'm curious, when I heard about it years ago, I thought to myself, I remember, you know, obviously you're still very beautiful, hun. And I remember the pure power of the star power that emanates from you. And I thought to myself, this was a few years where I had this thought. I thought, I wonder how this condition has changed the way you look at your work, the people who work with you, because of there's a lot of famous people. How your views of fame and sort of star power, how does that change when you are living with this condition for a few years?
Oh, gosh. You know, it's been so long now that I don't even remember how life was before, you know, honestly. Oh, goodness. You know, first of all, I try to be as strong as possible. I mean, strong as much as possible. Is try to being, you know, trying to keep it
together.
Easy and keep it together, yeah, as much as I can. But it's not easy. The truth is, it's not easy. But I don't feel in any way sorry for myself. I do not feel sorry for myself. Yeah. I just wish, you know, that people. I mean, the thing is, at the same time, I don't like showing it off. You know, like social media. I hate. I don't. Some of my friends tell me that it's okay, huh, to show those bad days. You know, because you cannot always post good things, good days, because you don't have that. You know, that's not your life. Your life is mostly not good. So it's okay to share this with them. But I'm thinking, like, why would anybody want to see this? You know. And at the same time, but I guess it could encourage people to, you know, move, just to keep on going, keep on moving, like me, like myself. I think, like I said, I've said it before, I don't take things for granted at all. Now, these days, I'm grateful for everything. I'm little tiny successes every day, like I said, cooking. If I can cook a meal, that's my success of the day. So I think what my life has changed in terms of, I'm just grateful. I'm just incredibly grateful for everything, for anything and everything, because it's not the Nyanla, you know, that Mundukan. I'm grateful that I met my husband. I'm grateful that I have a man who takes care of me like this. I'm grateful for my friends and my family who go through this with me, and I'm just really grateful. I think that's what it. So yeah, but I understand that we all have our problems, Ken. Nobody has bigger. I think somebody has financial problems. That's like a major burden. Then the other person is cancer. It's a major burden. Yeah. Then there's a person, somebody, weight problems. You know, we all have problems. So I don't see myself in any way different from these people, from all the people, from everybody, because it's just another problem. It's just a problem, and you just learn how to deal with it, and move on. You know, so that's what it is. But I think it's sometimes I feel like it's affecting other people more than myself. I think it's the way people look at me, and people see me, people feel sorry for me. I can feel it. You feel how you know, like, you know, but what bothers me is if they want, they're waiting to see it. They're waiting to see me in a weak moment. I was at this meeting, and then I wasn't able to get up, you know, and so somebody was helping me up. And at the point, I saw somebody pulling out the phones and just filming me, because they just want to capture that, and just to show off to friends. I don't know. I can see how people are waiting to see something, to see how sick she is, you know, and that's just stupid. But I think all in all, my life hasn't changed. My life has definitely changed, but I don't think I've changed much in terms of how I see life. You know, I was grateful before. I'm grateful now. Maybe more grateful than I was before. I'm definitely more. Adjustments in my life. I have to adjust my life in many ways. I keep on thinking of for Shark Tank for some reason. I keep on thinking. I want to come up with things that make my life easier, because that would help a lot of other people too. Things, something like this. Like adjustments. Like I have to, when I buy something, I have to pay it. I pull out my wallet before I get to the cashier, because it takes forever to get the wallet out. When I go to the restroom, I have to go like right away. Don't wait, because it takes time to, you know. Yeah. So everything takes time. So yeah. But
you know, hun, just the exercise of you talking to me about all of these things, and just for me to hear how strong you are to continue and carry on with life and not stop and not give up and continue to talk about, if you can cook a meal a day, that's a success, you know. That's so inspiring to me, because, you know, you're absolutely right. I go through very, very hard days, and I think, you know, but my hard days can't be anything compared to your hard days, and your hard days might not be compared to somebody who's dealing with a dying, you know, kid. Their child is dying. So I think this is all relative, but to hear you talk about this stuff is at once very inspiring for me to hear and to kind of lock in the words, what you're saying, and bring it to heart, because you know, seeing you in this this way of living is a very inspiring way for me to kind of hear the testament that you go, you know, you're so grateful for everything that's in your life today.
Absolutely. It's I have no reason to be ungrateful, because it's actually, I'm talking about my work. Let's just say, for example, my work today. I'm working together with my husband as a stylist and creative director of photography. So we have clients who come to us who've never been photographed before, who are incredibly shy and insecure, you know. So back in the days when I was singing and I was performing on stage, I saw people dancing in front of me, and my job was to make them get into the mood, party, drink, and all this stuff, and just have a good time. Now I'm working one-on-one with the client, and I'm working with people who are incredibly insecure, don't know what they're doing, awkward in front of the camera, but want to look good. So that's my job. My job is to make them feel and look good. And, you know, it's amazing to see, Ken. I'm telling you, it's a transformation. At first, I'm really shy, and then very insecure. And then after 5-10 minutes, when my husband and I work, and we always encourage them and we cheer them, it's completely different. It's a completely different person. It's a person who is confident, joyful, happy. And so that makes me feel like, okay, now after all these years that I'm performing and dancing and singing, that I already felt like I was bringing joy in people's lives, and I make a difference, I guess, for that night. At least I feel like I'm making a difference again. But this time it's actually more. It goes deeper. It goes into even though it's just physically, but it goes into the psychological part, where they are more, you know, believe in themselves more, and they see that they can do it. You know, they thought they couldn't, but now they understand that, hey, it doesn't take much to look good. It takes time. It takes, of course, some help, but anybody can look good. Not on, it's not that celebrities are born good looking. The celebrities
are
have
made.
The money to afford even, right. to afford the team to make them look good. So it's the same thing here. And we as a team, Pia and I as a team, we've got to make you look good, and we're going to boost your confidence. And it's just that's my rewarding part, where I feel like, you know, maybe, you know, that's a habit for a reason that I don't sing anymore, because now I appreciate, you know, the interaction. I appreciate, you know, my work as some sort of like a therapist, you know, to make them feel better about themselves. So that's how I see it.
You, I imagine the long way, the life that you have is you have a long runway left to do all the things that you want to do. Are there other things that are left that that you really want to accomplish in, you know, in your life?
Yeah, two things. One thing that my husband keeps on encouraging me over and over again is to write a book. And he goes, he said, just you write it, and we're gonna send it to Netflix, and it's gonna be like a 3-season show, because first season is gonna be your life in Austria. Second season is you and Paris Bernays. Third season you and Parkinson. So 3 seasons. So he spent time with me to write my autobiography. That's for sure. And then number two, which is something that I really, really, you know, regret that I didn't try. And I don't think it's never going to happen. It's too late now. It's to get into acting. I would really love to get into acting. But it's out of question now. Right now, it's not possible. I mean, I can't. I don't think I can get through this. Especially, what kind of role should I be playing like this, other than a sick person? But yeah, so those are the things, the two things that I wish I would have done.
Yeah, and I think with the writing, it's, you know, it can be done. But then you have to ask yourself, why don't you want to write? Why haven't you done it? You know?
Yeah, it's been, you know what, the thing is, it's a practical thing, because I obviously can't type, you know, typing is very difficult for me because my hands are all over the phone and the iPad. It's just,
that's hard.
I apologize. I always have to tell people, I apologize in advance. If you ever see on Facebook that somebody reported your photo, it's not because I reported the photo. It's because my finger did. I'm sorry. I have to be really careful with what I do. I mean, my finger, like, don't like. And then it does. And I was like, no, why? I'm like, you don't, it's embarrassing. And then I'm like, certain profiles you're not supposed to check, and then no, like, damn finger.
Yeah, so I think, yeah, I could see how that could be a very difficult thing to carry out, the writing, you know.
It's the right, yeah. And then when I speak, when I dictate, speak, Siri doesn't understand my English. Siri doesn't, it's, I guess I have a German accent, so everything I say just comes out like totally wrong. Like, I mean, it's horrible. So it's a practical problem. So I need somebody who can, yeah.
You know, I have I have such a random question that I kept thinking about. You know, I recently read the autobiography of Schwarzenegger, and he's Austrian. And did you ever sort of like study his life or anything? Or were there parallels of his life and your life when you were growing up?
No, I never studied. I mean, I know of him and everything, but I have not studied his life. I have no idea what he did. Then he went to America, and then
His dream was to get out of Austria. And when I listened to your story, I go, wow, I wonder, were there any lessons or parallels that you drew from Schwarzenegger's life? Because he left when you were, we were all very, very, very young. If not, he left before we were even born or came to Austria or the United States. But when you read his autobiography, you realize the dreams that he had coming out from an Austrian society. And Austrian society seems to be so dedicated to discipline and just very sort of like straight and narrow, and not like the American way, right?
It's funny that you ask. So, you know, the truth is, when I was in Austria, I want, just like Schwarzenegger, I want to get out of Austria. But now that I'm out of Austria, I love going back again. I don't think I can ever live there again, but it's something that I truly miss, because you know it's such a beautiful country, and it's the architecture and the history, everything is so lovely. But I the mentality, from the mentality, I don't think I can live in Austria anymore. And that was, for me, that was a big thing. I can relate to that. I can relate to the fact that I wanted to get out of Austria because there were obviously more opportunities for me in the US. And I remember one time when I was back in Austria, and in a group conversation, so we met some people, with my friends, and then I guess somebody's parents. And then in the conversation, I mentioned that I was a singer. And the reaction was just like, there was no reaction. Just like,
wow.
Like, yeah. It's like, you are like nobody, you're nothing, because you have no academic kind of like, you have no title, you know? So that's why I felt, you know, when in the US, when you say you're a singer, you're like, what you are? It's a job. It's just a job like any other jobs. But in Austria, it's not a job. It's just something like you like to do, and it's not a serious job for sure. Yeah. So they look at you differently.
Yeah. Wow. Well, hun, thank you so much. Today, you know, it was so lovely to spend time with you and to hear the journey that you took. You know, I didn't know much about your life. Even when we met, I just knew you were this, I was trying to remember how we met, but I couldn't remember who introduced. Yeah,
I tried to remember too. Like, I don't remember how we met. I don't remember anymore, but yeah. I think it was, it must have been through Hua, I guess.
No, Hua met you through me.
Jubilee, right?
Yes, I do know those.
Jubilee was dating Anson at the time. Anson, and then I guess Anson was friends with Kim and all these guys. I don't know if you know them.
Jubilee and Juklang are very close to my cousin. They grew up with my first cousins, but I don't think that we met that way. I see Juklang and Jubilee all the time, but that I don't recall us meeting that way. I think we met through another promoter who was probably a student at USC as well at the time. That's who I can remember when I think back about those times. But I mean, for you to even have the confidence in me to say, you know, I'm going to go up there and do it with, you know, I'm going to sing a song with you. And it's like, it was a very difficult song, as I remember. And I wish we had the video and had it and still kept the video.
Yeah. So today would be on all over social media for sure. If it had happened today, but yes. No. But I have to say, you are an amazing singer. You are an amazing singer. I love it. I love the way you play. I didn't know you played the piano. That's new. That's something I never knew. All of a sudden, hallelujah! I'm like, oh, okay, hallelujah! Jesus Christ, where is this coming from? Wow, I'm impressed. Good job.
It was a wonderful evening. It was such a wonderful evening playing and singing with you and tea. It was awesome. Awesome memories. I hope that the next time you and tea come out to California, that we can all get together again and you know, do what we did. That was a really fun night.
Yeah, come to Houston sometimes. You should come to Houston. It's very nice. It's very nice. Yeah, actually, I mean, it's booming. It's growing. It's all over the place. So actually, it's a good place to be here right now.
Yeah.
And I read an article on I think LA Times that lots of Californians are actually emigrating moving to Florida. I mean to Texas. So I read about that.
Next time I'm out in Houston, I will definitely ring you and let you and T know, and we'll do something. Go get something to eat.
All right. Okay. Oh, I cook something. I can make.
Thank you, hun. And I could cook too. I would love to cook for you as well.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Ken. Appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trin. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok @The Vietnamese Podcast.